And all the guys giving me the thumbs up, so I guess that means it's time to go. Well, nice to see so many of you back for a second dose. And too much Fim is never enough. I'm afraid, not so many pretty pictures in this one, sorry. All the pictures are in the last one. Okay, Fim best practices. More best practices, but this time some technical best practices. Okay. When I first started planning this session, I realised pretty quickly I'd bitten off far more than I could chew in 1 hour. And, anyone who's working with Fim knows there's an awful lot to it. I really can't cover everything. So I've decided to focus on things I do in every project. Okay? And I have highlighted a couple of new R2 features as I'm going through. This is not an R2 update talk. There's resources you can go and read about, that sort of stuff. But as we pass anything, if it's new, I'll stick this little badge on it. So I'm focusing on the components that are the most commonly used ones, server architecture, sync service, the portal, and self-service password reset. Okay? Right, let's get going. So server architecture. There's a lot of different ways we can set these components up. I think this sort of layout is fairly common for the sort of environments that I've seen. Back in the past, we used to always say we should put the sync service database with the sync service on the same server because it uses its database so intensively. That doesn't seem to be such an issue these days. We've got our gigabit backbones. We're all using VMs anyway. So mostly, actually, now I tend to say, no, let's put those databases where they're going to be looked after properly. So if there's a cluster and the SQL team are looking after that, making sure everything's backed up and re-indexed and all that sort of thing, then that's a perfectly good home for our databases. Obviously, the other components can all run on one server if they have to. Separating them out often makes good sense, particularly with the password reset portal. If we have external users coming in and using that portal, then we really want to put it on a separate box. As has always been the case, our SQL spec is the most important factor for performance. So put your resources into beefing up that SQL performance, the most common bottleneck. Failover, redundancy, again, not a lot has really changed. The only component that you can actually cluster is the SQL part. And even then, the product doesn't support automatic failovers of the database from one server to another. You'll still need to do some service restarts and that sort of thing. The sync service, really, standby server, is still about the only option that we've got. This is where we maybe have a second server that's pointing at the same database or a replicated copy of the database that we can activate very quickly. There's no actual failover there. Any portal components, however, we can load balance. And the other point there is about service partitioning of the FIM service. So that engine underneath the portal that is handling the requests, running the workflows, it is actually possible to install that on multiple servers for performance reasons. R2 adds a whole new set of architecture that we potentially need to worry about, with this reporting module that's built on System Center Data Warehouse. So System Center Data Warehouse has, quite a few things it needs. It needs its own databases. The recommendation is obviously to keep those separated from the FIM databases. We don't want our archiving load mixing in with our active FIM load. It's got these two servers, the System Center Service Manager and the System Center Data Warehouse service. They have to be on separate servers. Can't run together. Now, you could co-locate various of these things with your FIM servers if you are only setting this up for FIM reporting. There is a licensing thing there. If you're only setting up System Center Data Warehouse so you can use the FIM reporting, you don't have to pay for licenses. Personally, I think it's probably a mistake. Just for that. You know, I think if you're planning on putting System Center Data Warehouse in for other archiving, Active Directory archiving, System Center archiving, then great, but you're going to want to plan out that architecture separately to FIM. My understanding is it's not particularly extensible later. The decisions that you need to make early on with System Center Data Warehouse so that it has everything that you need long term. There are other ways we can do reporting, so I'm happy to discuss those with people if they're interested. There is a book out by David Lundell. He has just released a new version of this book for R2. And this is volume one of his proposed series of books. It's been taking a while for him to work on these. This one does just deal with sort of architecture, installation, planning, that sort of thing. But it is an excellent resource if you've got needs outside the ordinary for planning your architecture. And he's got a great discussion as well of the whole Kerberos thing. He's got this whole fairground thing, which he uses to describe and getting tickets to rides. It's very good. I understood it, actually, after I read that. There is now a best practices analyzer for FIM R2. Doesn't tell you a lot. It's mostly just focused on whether you've got all your SQL jobs running correctly. So, you know, it plays a role, but it's certainly not going to tell you anything about the configuration of FIM. Performance. So, as I said before, SQL is the most important factor. It is considered a best practice to re-index your FIM databases from time to time. There is a great resource here if you haven't come across this guy's site, Ola Hallengren. He's a SQL MVP, and he's got some fantastic scripts which do re-indexing and, you know, check how much re-indexing is needed before doing it and that sort of thing. Controlling transaction logs is extremely important, in fact, on both the Sync service database and the FIM service database. Certainly on the Sync service database, one of the things you can do is keep your run history clean, short. Now, run history in the Sync service, that's where it's keeping all those records of every single run job that's been done. There is actually not a lot of valuable information in there apart from just when did things run, you know, were there any errors. Myself, I don't keep more than a week. The more run history you have, the bigger your transaction logs need to be. And in fact, when you clear a lot of run history, it has to expand the transaction logs even further to do that. And that can actually cause real problems. I've seen people run out of disk space in that, and it's not pretty. Obviously, regular backups, that keeps the transaction logs under control. And also now with the FIM service, we actually have, you know, data in, well, in the FIM portal, we have data in there that might not be anywhere else. There may actually be data that we're mastering in the FIM portal, so we do need to keep that backed up very regularly. And just another tip, if you know that you're doing a big import of a new system first time, put the databases in simple recovery mode and it doesn't spawn a huge transaction log. So sync service performance. Put in indexing attributes used by joins and find MV entries. I'm sure everyone knows that. You know, when you try and do a join and the attribute's not indexed and it pops up a little message saying this attribute isn't indexed, there's no harm in indexing them. Anything that you're ever going to really search on in the metaverse, you should index. That's just a simple thing you can do. But it's hard to talk about other aspects of sync service performance because often it's down to the configuration. You know, a very inefficiently configured sync service will not run particularly well no matter how many resources you throw at it. Now, in my mind, the sync service is great at a couple of things. It's great at maintaining joins between identities, and it's great at synchronizing data through between them. What it's not so good at is constructing data. So people do this thing where their HR database has an employee table and a position table. And if you want to find out who someone's manager is, you have to go to the position table. So I've seen people do this. They import positions as objects. And then when they're importing the people, they do a find MV entries, find the position, hunt around, generate a reference attribute. You'll get away with it with a small data set. With a large data set, this can be completely crippling. So here's another thing that I like to do. It's this notion of putting a presentation layer between your data source and the sync service. And certainly when I first started writing, you know, found out how to write extensible management agents, I was very excited about this and I thought, you know, great, if there's not a management agent, I'll just write one. I'll go and query the application, the data source directly. it's actually not always the best idea. Sometimes it's very slow, very cumbersome, and often, quite frankly, the data is not in the format that FIM needs. So just like with that manager attribute, we need it to be presented to FIM in the appropriate format so it can make a reference attribute out of it, sync it through. So this notion of putting a layer between your data source and FIM is often very useful. And I like to use SQL tables, SSIS packages, generate a delta table while you're at it. And once again, you're really speeding up those FIM cycles while doing all your complex data handling somewhere else. Okay, so let's use the most powerful tools to do the jobs we need to do. Portal performance. One of the worst things that we've experienced so far with the FIM-MA was that initial bulk load through the FIM-MA. So you're populating the FIM portal for the first time. You've got thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of objects to get through that one bottleneck of the FIM-MA. And the performance in R1 was woeful. And the reason is that each individual object was sort of dealt with individually. So it took one object and then did the checking. What sets is it in? Do I need to run any workflows? Right, okay, now I'm ready for the next one. Ridiculous. When it did modifies, it actually batched them. It would actually do a few at once. So now with R2, the FIM-MA now automatically batches all exports through to the FIM portal. And you don't need to do anything to get this functionality, but you can tweak it through the config file. So there is a comment in the README about this, that if you have a high likelihood of errors, so for instance, missing attributes that are flagged as required in the portal, or attributes that don't match the validation strings in the portal, these will cause not just that individual object export to fail, but it actually upsets the whole batch. So if you have a high probability of that, the recommendation is to decrease the size of your batches. But certainly this is massively improved. I mean, I've seen bulk syncs go, I mean, I'm talking 32 times the performance, the speed of getting that data into the FIM portal. So this is a big improvement. So service partitioning, I mentioned before, this notion that we can run the FIM service on multiple servers. And a classic way to use this is we may have a FIM service that is dedicated to the sync service. So all our sync jobs just have one FIM service they can talk to, but our users, meanwhile, have another FIM service that's handling all their requests. So there is a change in R2 by default. The FIM-MA will use any available FIM service, and there is a config file change that you need to make if you want to restrict it to a certain one. So I just wanted to highlight that if you have that architecture. Another thing is sets. So another big performance limiting factor in the portal is lots of sets. And the fact is the way it works is every single change you make, it goes and checks through all the set definitions to see if that object now falls into one of those sets, even if the object types don't match. So it couldn't ever be in this set anyway. It still checks it. So the fact is, a lot of sets will slow things down. And it is apparently worse for union sets and not sets. So these are sets that where the membership refers to another set, resource ID in this other set. Now, I'm not saying don't do it, because it's very powerful, and the way the FIM portal is constructed is around sets. We need to use sets. So I'm just saying be aware. If your design does call for a lot of sets, then you may need to be beefing up your SQL performance, thinking about some service partitioning to handle that extra load. Right, sync service. Now, a lot of the stuff I'm going to say here is not new at all, and I'm sure a lot of people in this room already know this stuff. But I do think it's worth stating again because, you know, I've been in environments where the sync service has been set up and it seems to break every single best practice I hold dear. So people are still missing these points. The first one is that it's better if identities of the same general type outside FIM are all the same type inside FIM. And what I mean here is don't create separate object types for student, staff, contractor, you know, customer. You will be creating a nasty rod for your back at some point in the future. It is far better to say, well, they're a person in the real world, therefore they're a person in FIM. And a general way to think about it is if it's ever possible for an identity to transition from one state to another, then it should be the same object type in the metaverse. And I think I read somewhere, there used to be a way you could actually change object type in the metaverse with coded extensions, and I'm pretty sure I read that's being removed because it's a bad idea anyway. So use the person object type, define what they are with roles and with attributes. Represent each individual once in the metaverse. Again, this is a best practice. I know that people have weird exception-y circumstances, but something to aim for, each identity should exist once in the metaverse. If they need two accounts in a system, fine. We'll sort that out. But they shouldn't be twice in the metaverse just to support that. And this is just another general one. The quote here is from Hugh Simpson Wells from Oxford Computing Group. I did my training with him back in MIS 2003 days. And I really like this thing he said, your metaverse should be a shrine to good data. So as much as possible, if you're doing sort of data cleanup, you're saying perhaps, you know, just taking the strings that match a regex and rejecting the others, that sort of thing, do it on the way in or on the way out. Get the good data into the metaverse, and then our export flow rules will be much simplified because of that. And this is even more so with the portal, because now we may be replicating this information in the portal as well. We want people to see the best possible version of our identity metadata in the portal. Okay, here's a... Anyone using declarative sync? Is it just these two mugs down here? I'm not a fan. Look, here, you know, you can read that at your leisure, pros and cons of each. There is a new thing as well with R2, we get scoped outbound sync rules. So if you've had a play with the declarative portal-based sync rules, you would have found very quickly that the inbound ones were really straightforward. You just said, here's my source MA, this object type goes to this object type, put in some flow rules, bang, away it goes. Outbound, on the other hand, was a bit of a pain. We had to have a workflow that attached the synchronization rule and we had to have an MPR and, you know, it spawned all these objects as well, these expected rule entries and detected rule entries. So they have simplified this. We now have this notion of a scoped outbound flow rule where it's more like the inbound. Here's our metaverse object, here's our target object, here's some flow rules, go. It also doesn't spawn all those ERE objects that were cluttering up the metaverse. So, you know, it's an improvement, but it still has some limitations. Can't be used for deletion. And as Phil just pointed out to me earlier, I hadn't actually even thought about this, some stuff that we were doing with workflow data variables. It's not available there, where you could actually set some variables on the fly and then feed them through to the sync rules. So, you know, it's better, but only if the circumstances are right. So which should you use? They both will work together. Declarative is improved in R2, but, and this is the big problem for me, it's still not possible to do everything with declarative. And I'm a bit like, you know, I'll use it when I can do everything with it. It is possible to mix. I think if you are mixing, then you need to be very, very clear about how you're doing which part. So some examples. If you have a management agent that's quite simple and the declarative sync works fine for it, and it is nice, you know, it's GUI-based, it's point and click. You could potentially give someone access to change a couple of things, though I think you'd be nuts if you did. But, you know, you just have to be clear. This MA is declarative, this one's classic. My colleague Bob here, I don't even know if you've done this, did you? But he had some notion that maybe we could use classic for inbound. Get all our data, maybe have our complex rules, sorting our data in, getting it in, to our identity management system, and then we can have the declarative takeover with the fairly straightforward job of pushing stuff out. That's another way to think about it. Automating deprovisioning. Do not make decisions on an absence of data. So there's this classic mistake that I made, and I dare say other people have made it too. I know other people have made it. When you do your first project, and HR say to you, we will give you a list of all active employees. Active employees. So when someone disappears from the list, that's because they've gone. And you start going off and helpfully disabling all their accounts. Only in my case, the reason they disappeared was a SQL replication error. So never make decisions on an absence of data. Insist that you need to see those ex-employees with that past end date, whatever else you have in your environment, to make those decisions. Also, plan for bad data entry or SQL replication problems and make sure the changes can be easily reversed. So someone forgot to put, you know, a person's contract was extended, but someone forgot to put the new end date in HR. Fine, we disable their accounts, that's the process. When they put the new end date in HR, we should automatically be able to have everything back the same way as it was before. And so carrying on from this, don't make destructive changes straight away. Often customers will say to me, this is our process. The person leaves, we disable their account, we delete their mailbox, we delete their groups. And I say, fine, but not straight away. We're not doing that straight away. We need a grace period during which they can shout and complain because they haven't left at all. Right, MA best practices. This is a demo. So let's jump on the lab. Again, I don't think anything here is rocket science, but I'm going to tell you all anyway. Okay, so first really simple one. This source here is a projection data source. I'm projecting objects from this data source. I also have a join rule. Why do I need a join rule? Anyone know why I need a join rule? Yeah? It might already be there. Here's another thing I'm going to tell you. Always plan to be able to clear and re-import every connector space. Plan for that as a normal thing you might need to do. So if we clear that connector space, we already have the Metaverse objects, we want them to join straight back with no fuss. This goes for provisioning targets as well. So they talk about breadcrumbing. Export something out to that target identity that will give us a nice, simple one-off join rule in case we have to clear that connector space and re-import it back in. Okay, this does happen. The other thing I just want to mention, because this is a projection data source, and I'm probably joining here on something that I actually pushed into the Metaverse from this data source. And there's another thing here, this tick box. Do not recall attributes contributed from this management agent when disconnected. The default behavior is when an object is disconnected from either because it got deleted or disconnected some other way, then any attributes it contributed to the Metaverse object should be removed. Now you can tick this box, and what that does is it doesn't remove the attributes. I think that's a really bad idea. Now, you might do it just for a one-off thing. There might be some reason. But on the whole, here's why. I want to be able to look at that Metaverse object in isolation and be able to tell exactly what it's connected to. Now, when we're using classic sync rules, we have this function where we count connectors. So say I have an application and I only want to provision that once they've got an AD account. And I can say, count the connectors in the AD MA. Yep, there's one, go. But in declarative, in portal-based sync, all we see is the attributes on that Metaverse object. So say I've imported the Active Directory DN. I want to know for sure if it's got a DN, it's because it's in Active Directory, not because it used to be in Active Directory. So I never tick that box. But it does mean in terms of the joins, you need to think about this. If you've pushed an attribute into the metaverse and this object gets disconnected, it's going to delete that attribute unless you've also exported it out somewhere else. And then that MA can now contribute that attribute. So you just need to think ahead a little. Always plan to clear the connector space. Okay. Now there's a little new feature I wanted to show you in case you haven't noticed it. This one is available if you install update rollup 2 for R1. It's not just R2. And it's just the ADMA. They've added a new type of connector filter. So the old type was just a declared connector filter. I now have this import filter. That will actually stop the objects coming into the connector space in the first place. So anyone who's played with connector filters should immediately see that's quite useful. Just a little tip. Now what else was I going to show you? Ah, yes. Okay, this is a good one. Who's worked with a FIMMA? Yeah, a few people. So, one thing the FIMMA, is the management agent that connects between the sync service and the portal. And we are not allowed to do advanced flow rules. Now, the idea is supposedly that the data in the portal should match the data in the metaverse. Yeah, you know, in actual fact, I think there are many valid use cases where that shouldn't necessarily be the case. And we were so frustrated at this that my colleague down here, Bob, go and wave at everyone, Bob. Orange shirt, can't miss him. Had a bit of a brainstorm. Now, what we do is we, every time we do an import through the FIMMA, we drop a log file. So, full import log file, delta import log file. Now, our first thought was actually just to use that log file directly in another management agent, which we call the replay MA, because we're replaying the last import. We did find the XML management agent didn't have quite the functionality we needed, so it was better to convert the data to LDIF. So all we have is a nice little a PowerShell script and a style sheet. And the style sheet converts that XML drop file into LDIF, and we can then import that same data, and I'll just do a search connector space. I mean, basically, I have the objects from my FIMMA. I have a copy of all the data in my FIMMA connector space, and now I can do whatever I want with it. This is a normal management agent. If I want to have an advanced flow rule, I can. So here's just a little simple example. People have a first name and a preferred first name in the portal. They're allowed to manage their own preferred first name, and this is then used in all their accounts and their email address. In the metaverse, I don't actually really want both of them. In the metaverse, I just want to know what's the first name I should be using. I don't want to have to check every single time, do they have a preferred name set? No. Let's just have the first name they want to use in the metaverse. But in the portal, we still need the two separate ones. Simple little flow rule. Easy. So you'll be pleased to know, if you want to use this, the script and the style sheet are available, and you can get at them through the FIM team website. So just remember that, the FIM team. Go there, you'll find a link, and you can use the replay MA. One other little thing I wanted to show you, log files. Now, this is something I've been doing for years. Readers of my blog will be familiar with this. You can drop a log file on both import and export. I think it's a very good idea to keep those log files. But this log file here, this export XML, it's replaced every time. So you need something else. You need to run something after your export and import jobs that archives that file off somewhere else. And again, I've got a PowerShell, I've got a style sheet, and what I do is actually, there's a whole heap of them there, I actually convert it into a little HTML report and I stick them somewhere else. Again, that's available on our FIM team script site. And I can't tell you the number of times that someone said, you know, FIM changed something, and we've been able to search through these log files and actually track it back and say, well, you know, actually it was just responding to source data. It imported from somewhere else. So that's definitely a best practice of mine. Okay, I'll do for MAs. Portal and policy. So this is very much this first point, what I already said about the metaverse. We do have to have a one-to-one match on metaverse object type if we're doing synchronization through the FIMMA. So basically, you know, the same rules apply. If it's a person, they should be a person. Now, I was talking to this guy in the States who works for Emma's Consulting Services, and he's been called in to basically completely redesign. It's a massive installation, 300,000 identities, I believe. And there is a bit of a limitation in the portal that there are only three forms available for each object type. So if it's a person, you get your one create form, your one edit form, your one view form. They wanted more. So they had gone and created different object types in the metaverse just so they could have more forms. It was a disaster. And so he is now in there, and they are going to have to completely re-architect this system from the ground up because they made that fundamental error. So keep the object types matching what they actually are in the real world. I tend to put my validations and friendly descriptions on the binding instead of the attribute. You know, the attribute may be then bound to other object types. The last thing I wanted to mention here is when you're looking at schema in the FIM portal, you have to start thinking in an object-oriented way. In the portal, everything's an object. You make a request, there's a request object. It spawns an approval object, and then there's an approval response object. Everything's an object, and there's all relational links between them. So things tend to work better when we follow this approach as well. And I apologise for this crummy picture, but that was just an old screenshot from the system I did a while back. But what this actually was doing mailbox delegations in the FIM portal. And I actually created a delegation object. And the delegation object had the target mailbox, the person being given the permissions, and then the nature of this role. So you think about that. This is like a three-dimensional relation, really, because the relationship itself has attributes. So I created another object type, and this is what it looks like in the person's properties. They can actually see exactly who's got access to their mailbox and what roles they have. Now, this is displaying another object, but the user doesn't know that. It makes things a lot more extensible when you start thinking in this way. Right, policy best practices. Go back. Okay. What have I got for this? Let's see if I can remember everything I was going to show you. Okay, management policy rules. My first tip on management policy rules is to... Who's working with the portal again? Show of hands. Not that many people. So do I need to tell you what a management policy rule is? Yeah, maybe. Okay, so basically in the portal we have sets. So it's this state-based thing where all our objects are in sets. And then we have workflows. And the way we trigger those workflows, there's a couple of different ways. There's the set transition way. So when an object transitions from this state to this state, we want to trigger some workflow. And then there's the request way, where you say, the requester is in this set, and the target's in that set, and this then gives them the permission to modify certain attributes of the target, and while we're at it, we may want to trigger some workflows. So the way we handle that relationship is with the management policy rules. So I'll just show you one, click through one. Let's go for a request-based one. So I give it a name, I say who my requesters are, in this case I've got all people, what they're allowed to do, whether this grants permission to do stuff, what the target resources are, all people again, specifically what the attributes are. So this here says if anyone modifies these attributes, well then we want to go and do something. And this is where we have our workflows. And in this case, I was actually triggering a sync if they made that particular change. Now, here's the point I want to make. It's possible, and quite a lot of the out-of-the-box MPRs are like this, it's possible to have granting permission and triggering workflows in one MPR, but you shouldn't do it. It's much better if you separate grants permission from workflow triggering. And if you look here, I've got my User access control, one's up the top, and then I've got my user workflow, one's down the bottom. And the great advantage is that with the workflow ones, I don't have to worry so much about how the change got made. My grants permission workflows have all the complexity about who can do what to whom and under what circumstances. That's all in the grants permissions. So I don't care. The change got made, let's trigger something. So that means now that all my workflow MPRs are either set transition, the object transitioned from this state to this state, but we don't care how, or, like this one I just showed you, the requester is all people. So I don't have to worry too much about who the requester was because my grants permission MPRs are controlling all of that. And there's another really good reason why you should do things this way. There's an error that happens if two workflows try and update the same attribute at the same time. And if you have a whole lot of different MPRs that are potentially running the same workflow, then you really raise the risk of this happening. This way, I'm kind of putting all my business complexity into my grants permission MPRs and then, you know, literally maybe just have one MPR triggering each workflow. I'm really minimizing the risk of that happening. There's another thing I wanted to say just about workflows in general. Where's my example? I want to do the create new user one, generate attributes for new people. Actually, look, maybe I should show you what a workflow looks like. There's people here not working with the FIM portal. Here's a get approval one. Not very fast. So this is just doing one simple thing. It's asking for approval from some group of people. Got some mail templates there we can send. I've got other ones that do things like set account name. Okay, this is a good one because here I'm actually using a little custom attribute I wrote here. So in this one I generate a bunch of different possibilities for what they're, if I edit that, that looks a bit better. I generate a bunch of different possibilities for what the account name might be. Put them into these variables, option 1, 2, 3, and 4. And then I have a custom activity down here. Cancel that first. Which will basically just do a very simple, try the first one, is it unique? No. Try the second one, is it unique? So this is the other thing that we can actually extend this and we can actually go into Visual Studio and Windows Workflow Foundation and write our own little activities there as well. So that's very briefly workflows. But the thing that I wanted to say is that it works better if you keep these workflow activities doing preferably just a single discrete task. So another thing I did first off, I want a workflow that generates attributes for new users. And so I kind of did step, 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 all in one workflow. Do the display name, do the account name, do the this, do the that. It's much better if you actually break them down into these little workflows that are really just performing one task. And firstly, it's really easy to see. I can see exactly what this MPR is doing. Secondly, it's more reusable. So my set display name workflow there, I can now use that as well when someone changes their name. And the other thing, again, it minimizes that risk of workflows conflicting and running at the same time and causing trouble because we're not embedding set display name in a number of different workflows. We have it right there, we can see it. Now, the reason that you do have multiple steps in one workflow is when you really do need to force them to run in a particular order. Obviously, you will still have to do this. You can't control the order these run in. You sort of have to assume they're all happening at the same time.
Just on that one, Carol, when you're doing it, are you using workflow data and then saving it on the actual object?
Yeah. So that was like writing the options into workflow data, and then in my custom activity, I just step through them. Okay. Just one other thing I was going to show you. This is only going to interest people who are actually working with this stuff. But I did a little script, again, available on our FIM team site. And what I did was I wanted to know when I look at a workflow or look at a set, I want to know which MPRs are using that. So when I'm looking at the MPR itself, I can see the sets it uses, I can see the workflows it triggers. I wanted that information back the other way. That's not there out of the box, but just to show it is quite simple to extend the schema, I just added this referring MPRs attribute to both the workflow definition and the set definition object types. Little PowerShell script, and that just goes and populates this information for me, and I've got it on the sets as well. So it's very, very easy for me to see straight away what those objects are being used for. Okay, that's all I was going to say there. Right. Everyone's using PowerShell, aren't they? Yeah? Yes? Good. You can't do the FIM portal without PowerShell. Now handles dates. Yes. Anyone who is working with FIM R1 and PowerShell will be pleased about that. There's a lot of functions that we want to do in the portal, like bulk inserts, bulk changes, and that sort of thing. It's a little hard to do in the portal sometimes, but PowerShell opens up a lot of that to us. There is a function library available on TechNet, which I use all the time. It's just, save it, refer to it, top line of your PowerShell script, and it just makes all these sort of add value, add multi-value kind of commands a lot simpler. So do look at that. There's some resources for you. So I've got a link to our FIM team community site. I do have a few scripts on my blog as well. Right, I did want to call this out. So there's one of the FIM MVPs, Craig Martin. He's the PowerShell FIM MVP. He's very keen on PowerShell, that young man. And he's written a really nice little workflow activity. This is available on Codeplex. And this just very simply runs a PowerShell script from inside a FIM workflow. And the really interesting thing he's done is he actually passes the request object through to the PowerShell script. So the request object has all the good stuff in it about who made the request, what was the target, what were they trying to change. Even when I showed you those workflow datas that I was putting those options in, I mean, quite frankly, I'm planning on rejigging, recreating my generate unique thing as a PowerShell script. I think this will actually take away a lot of the need to develop custom workflows. Actually, a lot of the stuff I've been doing, I could see myself doing it with a PowerShell script. So do look into that. And he's got some sample scripts available as well. It's a very cool thing. Right, UI configuration. Who's worked with RCDCs? Well, these guys have. Yeah, well, I know you have. Okay, not that many people. Bear with me. I just wanted to show this because I just thought this was really neat. Those few people who've experienced the you forgot to bind an attribute and now your whole RCDC is broken kind of thing. FIM R2 just very politely blanks out the attribute and gives you a little message down the bottom. So I was very excited when I saw that. You would have to have experienced the pain to know why that's good. Editing RCDCs, always use an XML aware editor because it'll help you enormously with all tag endings and quotes and all that sort of thing. And if you don't close one tag, your whole form is broken. I should say RCDCs, I'm talking about those pop-up forms. So user edit, all those sort of things. Everything that kind of pops up as a form inside the FIM portal has this thing called an RCDC behind it. XML based, you can go in there and hack the thing. There is an RCDC editor available from what's called Tools for FIM. It's actually Oxford Computing Group. I don't know, is anyone here using it? Using a film? I used an early version. It wasn't that great. I do hear it's better now, so you might want to look into that. That is, there's a small amount of money to pay for that. Might simplify the whole editing nightmare a bit. I will say test after each change. Make one change and test it. And while you're testing, the documentation says you have to do a full IIS reset. You actually don't. You can actually just get away with recycling the SharePoint app pool, which is a lot quicker. And I did write a little script. I don't think I've got a link there, but I did write a little script to actually just go and upload the new RCDC, recycle the pool, test, upload, recycle, test. there it is. I did put a link. Okay. Look, again, I'm not going to go into this in detail. Those of you working with RCDCs will know this already. But I just want to point out that in the RCDCs there are, you know, as much as possible, we don't want to be hard-coding things. If the information is available anywhere else, we want to get at it. And we can actually use some things from the schema directly in the RCDC. So there I'm saying take the caption from the name of the attribute. Take the description from the description that I've typed in to the attribute in the schema. So that then makes it a lot simpler to modify than having to go in and hack the XML. Same with this required. So we can flag attributes as required in the schema, and we can then just use that information in our RCDC. This is another one we can use is rights. So you do have to sometimes add this to the controls. It's not there already, but this will allow a little bit of dynamic operation in the form. If someone doesn't have rights to read a particular attribute, it doesn't even appear. So always add that one. String resources. Again, you know, there's various places where there's text, so these tab headings, this no photo specified sort of information message. There's hints that we can put underneath the fields. And again, we don't want to hard code these in the RCDC as much as possible. So there is a thing called string resources. Do I have a picture? I do. It's on the second page of the RCDC control. It's all that horrible XML rubbish there. It's actually designed for multi-language support. So the idea is we can put these variables in our form, which are then replaced by the appropriate language version. But even in a single language environment, I find this really useful because I've got a picture of the... There we go. So this is these percent symbol underscore blah, blah, blah. They're our variables. And up the top is just a little snippet out of the string resources XML. And it's just a lot simpler. It's just variable name, value. And you don't even have to have something in it. I've got one there where I've got an empty string. So I will actually literally go through and populate every single control with a hint, even if we're not using it. Because it's much simpler to maintain that text in the string resources. And also, it doesn't break your whole form if you do something wrong in string resources. The form still works, it's just the text goes a bit funny. Okay, option selection. So as I said in my previous talk, we're fighting the good fight against free text. As much as possible, we want to give people lists of options to choose from. And I think everyone first starts with the notion of the string list. So the employee type, it's a string attribute, it's bound to the user object. We've got a couple of different options for it. We'll just give them a drop-down list. And the simplest way to do this is with this validation string. So this is on the binding object in the schema. I can add this validation string. That will reject any object that doesn't have one of those values. But I can also use this to populate a drop-down list. So that's very nice. But as we all find out 5 minutes after thinking isn't that cool, this is extremely character limited. I think it's something like 128 characters. You run up against it in no time at all. So what are you going to do? You've got far more options than that. Oh, that's just what it looks like in the RCDC. Right. The other thing we can do is actually hard code the options at the top of the RCDC. You can actually define this data source block at the top of your RCDC. There, you know, it's hard coding, isn't it? And so as much as possible, that's what it looks like in the RCDC. You know, as much as possible, I prefer not to hard code things. So once again, it's going back to this idea of it's better to think of things in an object-oriented way. So when you're offering people lists of things to choose from, those things to choose from should be objects. And there's a couple of great advantages here. We can give them a search functionality. We have unlimited option list. We're just adding new objects. We have a good choice of controls. I'm going to show you those in a sec. We can do various filters. So we can say only show objects that match this filter, or we can base it on permissions. This person only has the right to access this subset of those objects. And the other thing we can actually do is delegate the upkeep of this list. So either we can give the appropriate person permissions to go into the FIM portal and add new of these option list objects, update them, or even better, we can get the sync service to do it. If there's some data source out there we can tap into, import those in as objects out to the portal, and it'll keep itself up to date. So let's have a look at some of those. Right, let's open a person. Okay, what's the first one I was going to do? Okay, cost code here. So this is a list view control. So these are our cost code objects, but basically I'm just offering them to the user in a nice simple tick box list. This is really useful if you need to display some extra columns, but also I think if you don't have a whole lot of options, you don't really want people to have to page through this. It's a reasonably short list. Now the other thing to note about this control is that for some reason it's for multi-value attributes only. So to make this control work, I actually had to define cost code as a multi-value attribute. However, I only want people to have one cost code, but that's fine because you just set the control to single select mode and we can only have one. So that's a nice one. Next we'll look at the classic identity picker. So here we have a lot of objects. This is the ideal one where you have a lot of objects to choose, or a lot of options, I should say, to choose from. And so you want to be able to give people a search functionality, make it a bit easier for them to find what they're looking for. The other thing we can actually do here is we can add search scopes. So a way to then limit, and in fact if I leave gold there and search, I'll now only see the Australian search scopes. So this is your friend if you have a lot of different options and people need to search. There's another tweak on the identity picker, and I did one on assistant. So this time I didn't need to click search. The options just appeared straight away, but I actually don't have a search box. It's the same control, but instead of using a search scope based filter, we use just a straight XPath filter. And all I've said here is show me all the people whose account name starts with F. So again, this is probably good if you've got, you know, not so many choices, so people don't have to page through that too much. But you can control these columns that they'll see. The last control I wanted to show you, and I mentioned before the grey area of undocumented. This one's undocumented. It's actually a guy who blogs by the name of The Fim Guy, who I believe actually works in Western Australia, but I've never met him anyway. It's on his blog, so shout out to him for finding this out. Here we have a department selection. They are objects, but this looks like just a nice text-based drop-down list. So, you know, here we can just go and select our option. The user is none the wiser that there's an object behind that. So, you know, it's nice. I like it. But do be wary of undocumented stuff. It has been broken in the past by hotfixes, helpfully. But, you know, if it was my own site I was managing day to day, I'd probably be happy to do that. There's one little final step to this. I'm just going to submit that change. What I've actually saved to this guy's properties is not actually department equals production, the string, but department equals GUID, the link to the other object. And this isn't very great if you then want to synchronize that out to Active Directory. So we do need that string value. And so there is a little final piece to this. And you'll see here that I've actually gone and done that. So department, where is it? There it is. So we have our linked reference one, but we also have the string. And that's because I just have a simple little workflow that is copying the display name from that linked object, set department from linked department object. And you see, this is pure out-of-the-box functionality. You don't need to do anything fancy for this. It's very straightforward. Function evaluator. And I just copy. This is just the XPath. So the target, follow the department link, get the display name, and copy it to the department field. And then the piece that then ties that all together is the MPR. So there'll be something there, update department when department link changes. And again, because I'm letting my grants permission MPRs worry about who's allowed to change department, all I need to say here is someone changed it. someone in all people modified a single value attribute. The single value attribute they modified was, this is actually department link. I made the display name on the binding object department, so that's what appears in the RCDC because I want to get that from the schema. But underneath that, that's my reference attribute. So someone changes that, and let's just fire off this little workflow here. Okay, very straightforward, but just the last little step that you have to do to get that happening. Okay, what have we got next? Yeah, I just wanted to point this out. I'm sure everyone's heard about this by now if they're working with the FIM portal. There is a bit of a change in R2 to the way search scopes work. So search scopes, you know, when I did that drop down Australia and I typed Gold Coast or typed gold and I saw all the ones that started with gold, well, you used to get all the ones that had the word gold in it somewhere. And then they went and changed it, so it all starts with, and apparently this was a great improvement. However, a lot of us were using that contains functionality. So in R2, there is a way to override it. They've given us this advanced filter thing. I don't know why they couldn't have just left the default functionality the way it was and you could override that, but anyway, this is the way they've done it. There is a PowerShell script as well on the TechNet Wiki, which you can actually run to basically set all your search scopes back to how they worked in R1. So I just want to point that out. Right. Couple of slides about self-service password reset. So I just wanted to make sure everyone understood the architecture for self-service password reset when you have people coming in from the outside. You do not put the password reset portal in the DMZ. The password reset portal stays inside, and then you use a reverse proxy to proxy the traffic forward and back. Okay? And here, I know you can't see that tiny writing, but FIM1 has the FIM service and FIM portal, you know, for internal people, and then FIM2 has our password registration and password reset portals. So, you know, if you do have those external users coming in, you're going to want to have those on their own server. And up until this morning, that said external access via Microsoft TMG. Had to change it. Supposed to work for, you know, generic reverse proxy as well. Okay, so some new features with our self-service password reset in R2. We have a web portal front end, hooray. This is neat. Pre-registration PowerShell commandlets. So, I mean, this would probably be really good, I think, for education environments where they want to actually go ahead and just register all the students for self-service password reset without forcing them to go and do it themselves. And, you know, maybe using student ID and some other information that we have about them. So that's a neat new addition. And we have this extra option. We can still just type a new password into the portal, but we also have these one-time password gates now. I gather with the SSMS one, you do need to have a way, obviously, to send an SSMS. FIM's not doing that itself. It needs to forward that message on to the server that can then do the SSMS. Changes with the workstation client. My understanding now is that if you have the client installed on a workstation, you get a link underneath the control alt delete login prompt that says, you know, reset my password. So that if you're sitting at the point to log in and you've forgotten your password, you just need to click the link. That used to use an ActiveX control installed on the workstation. Now it actually just sends you to the password reset portal. And I gather people who had issues with branding and that sort of thing would be very happy to hear this. A couple of best practices, as we are talking about best practices. So the workstation client is probably better in environments where it's a sort of a one-person, one-workstation type thing, and not so great in lab environments where you've got a lot of different people logging in and out. The reason is that the client actually checks if the person is registered at each new login, and that can actually slow the computer down and cause some network traffic that you might not want. If you're going to have a lot of self-service password reset activity, then it is definitely recommended to have a dedicated FIM service for just that activity. Now, this is a good one. I sent some emails around in Unify asking my various colleagues who work with FIM for their best practices, and we had a bit of a thread going on password reset. This was the number one best practice Because apparently if you let a committee choose the questions, it'll take them 6 months. And they will argue about whether they're PC, and maybe that person never had a, you know, a boyfriend, girlfriend in high school, and so we shouldn't ask that question, and, you know. So it's just the number one recommendation, they all said. Good security questions. I know there are other websites out there as well that have lists of, you know, fairly bland security questions that you can take. One problem, though, with this is it does sort of counteract a little bit the next best practice, and that's that if you go and change the questions later, people are forced to re-register. So you do need to get the questions right at the start, but you certainly don't want to go into some horrible rabbit hole of people arguing about whether they're PC or not. Okay, and I think that was all the content I had. So, questions? Everyone's stunned. Maybe too much Vim is enough.
Have you done any upgrade with so you would have done upgrades, but have you got any horror stories from upgrading from R1 to R2?
R1 to R2. I must admit, I haven't done a production upgrade. I've only done a lab upgrade for R1 to R2, and that went pretty well. I will say, I mean, I kind of uninstalled everything. So I tried to follow the steps and it didn't quite work, so I ended up completely uninstalling the sync service. I uninstalled the FIM service. I even uninstalled SharePoint, and I even deleted the Windows internal database and basically started again. Everything's in the databases, so you can do that. So then it was just a simple matter of reinstall all the services, point them at the databases, and it was all good to go. So that was, I have only done that in a dev environment, but it actually is, it's a copy of a production environment with a lot of management agents and a lot of stuff going on, a lot of policy, and yeah, it seemed to be good. I certainly got some good horror stories for you though on MIIS and ILM to FIM upgrades, which I can regale you with over a beer at the party if you like. Bob. But you see, as I've said to you before, Bob, that was your mistake, using declarative. Okay, well, look, anyone is welcome to come and chat to me anytime. I'm around all week. Well, it's only a day and a half left now, isn't it? But always happy to chat. Thank you.